From the Sky News Centre at 6, Freddie Starr says he will voluntarily speak to police in connection with alleged abuse carried out by Jimmy Savile. The former television presenter has denied any allegations against him. His lawyers claim police have no intention of questioning him, but he says he's more than willing to talk.
I've always said from the word go that I wanted to be interviewed for this when it first came out. I've always said I wanted to be interviewed.
The former Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, has been found guilty of tax evasion. He's been handed a 4-year sentence following a 6-year long trial. The latest search for British toddler Ben Needham, who went missing in Cos 2 decades ago, has this evening been called off. Officers from the UK flew out to the Greek island last week to examine a patch of ground close to where the 1-year-old was last seen in 1991. 11 former care workers have been sentenced for abusing vulnerable people at a home in Bristol. 6 have been jailed after the scandal at Winterbourne View. Police are hunting for a man who's believed to have committed a serious sex attack while on the run from an open prison in Lincolnshire. Detectives say 47-year-old Ivan Leach, also known as Lee Cyrus, is dangerous and shouldn't be approached. Many of us may have started cranking up the heat, but now another energy firm's cranking up its prices. EDF is the latest supplier to announce bill hikes. They'll go up nearly 11% from December. Shadow Environment Secretary Caroline Flint says the government must act to protect vulnerable customers.
Some of the people who lose out on the cheapest deals are those who are over the age of 75, who are most at risk of ill health from cold, but also are least likely to be online and therefore get these cheaper online deals.
And Team GB's hockey star Hannah McLeod says she's relieved that her missing Olympic bronze medal is on its way home in the post. It was taken from a London nightclub earlier this week. That's the latest. I'm Kat Collins.
The Gnostic Institute of Anthropology in Bristol is pleased to present a new course, Self-Knowledge in Modern Times. The course has public lectures and practices of meditation. You're invited to attend on Friday the 26th of October at 7 p.m. at the Beacon Centre. That's BS59JH. Admission is completely free, and for more information, just go to Gnostic, that's GNOSTIC-institute.org. Freedom is something that needs to be achieved within oneself.
This little piggy went to market. This little piggy stayed at home. And this little piggy chucked its burger carton on the pavement because it was too lazy to stick it in the bin. Still, it did get a £75 fine.
Dropping litter makes you look a right pig, and it could get you a spot fine of 75 quid. So don't be stupid, bin it, and keep our city looking tidy. To find out more about Bristol's litter campaign and why it matters, visit bristol.gov.uk/litter.
The One Love Breakfast on BCFM 93.2.
I'm Mel Mason, more from me in 20 minutes.
You're sat there. Yeah, aww. But I was twiddling me knob. We do have to say, it does flash rather aggressively as well. I think that's what freaks us out all of a sudden. No, I'm going to get something out for you. I feel that I can trust you too. I was a bit disgusted this morning because I just sort of looked at Summit and I thought, hang on, that ain't right. That's far too small.
News, weather, travel on BCFM's One Love Breakfast.
Listen to the One Love Breakfast on a Friday from 7 a.m. with Tristan B.
The One Love Breakfast.
And stay with us as we bring you this shock announcement in the last 15 minutes of the resignation of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Momentous events at the Treasury this evening as it's emerged yesterday's figures indicating the end of the recession were inaccurate. Citing family concerns, the Chancellor stepped down at 5:45 p.m. this afternoon to be replaced by the Business Secretary. In his first act, the new Chancellor issued an executive order with immediate effect as London exchanges closed for the weekend. All privately run UK banks are being requisitioned by Her Majesty's Government. In a statement, the Business Secretary said that the new Chancellor said the Treasury personnel appointments are being made to the boards of these corporations with immediate effect. The statement goes on to say the Prime Minister is in full accord with the measures which have been in preparation for several months, and again as the contingency for domestic stabilisation and recovery. Just over £4 trillion of corporate, domestic and international debt has been seized by the Treasury. Civil servants are being appointed to Lloyds TSB and RBS boards tonight. Dollar and euro exchange rates have been fixed at their present level, as well as a two-month extendable regime of exchange controls instituted from close of markets at 6pm today. This means all electronic and cash transfers out of the country over £1,000 will be automatically blocked by an electronic financial firewall the Treasury has placed around the UK. The final measure in this executive order is seizure of offshore assets of UK citizens and corporations, thought to total around £15 trillion. Monies will be released and returned to account holders in UK tax jurisdiction on a one-off payment of 15% of offshore tax haven tax. So, to summarise all three aspects of this complex order the new Chancellor has signed, all British banks have been nationalised with civil servants answerable to the Cabinet on the boards. The UK now has a strict regime of exchange controls for the first time since 1981, and exchange rates with the dollar and euro are fixed for 2 months. And finally, a one-off tax on offshore account holders, a momentous move indeed. The Prime Minister and his new Chancellor, former Business Secretary, are due to address the nation on ITV and BBC at 10 o'clock this evening. So many will be asking, how will the markets react? Well, Wall Street's Dow Jones is down 800 points, which, and we're just checking the figures, which is the lowest since 2008. European markets are now closed. To see how markets in European capitals react, we're going to have to wait until Monday. Meanwhile, the nation awaits tonight's live television broadcast to the nation by the new Chancellor, Vince Cable, at 10pm this evening. So for now, back to the studio. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. With old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. On the anniversary of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast that shocked America, we look at mind control. And the power of the NATO's own media to lead the unwary up the garden path. We also take a look at the little-known BBC radio drama experiment in 1926, which broadcast a pretend revolution in London, with the House of Commons being blown up by a massive crowd of armed Trotskyites. And we have a little look also at the legendary documentary filmmaker Alan Frankovich, hearing his eerie expose of CIA interference in Iran, and find out why it's so relevant to today's events. And as ever, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of some of the world's hotspots. But first, media mind control, and back to 1938. Martin, this was the War of the Worlds, the famous War of the Worlds experiment by Orson Welles, but a lot of young people haven't necessarily heard about this. It was the idea being that it was an invasion from Mars, but the thing is, millions of Americans actually believed it was really going on. It took place on the night of Halloween in 1938.
Yes, and I think that was dear listeners do realise that Tony was making his own version of this at the beginning of the hour.
Well, there's a subtle difference in that mine was not quite so full of fear and it wasn't so frightening. Hopefully this was something which might actually be positive and make people smile rather than throw themselves out of windows, as we're told that some people did during that broadcast in the US back in 1938.
Well, don't forget that the radio, there weren't that many radio stations in those days, so people looked at the radio as an authoritative voice. We've now got a cacophony of things on the internet and so on, and people get their information from all sorts of places. Back in the old days, if somebody with a plummy voice came on the radio, you listened because that was the only information you were going to get.
Okay, so what was the relevance of all this today then? Because one of the things that I found fascinating about the War of the Worlds was that the connection between Harvey Quantrell, who was one of the people at CBS that helped organise this, and he was a writer on propaganda in the US in the run-up to the Second World War, that it was actually... he was actually wedded in with the whole kind of psychological warfare arm of the US Army.
Yes, and of course psychological warfare began in the First World War with, you know, people employed. Edward Bernays became one of the founders of public relations and Madison Avenue in the United States, and it's always been bound up with attempts to kind of basically manipulate people's political opinions.
So anyway, let's go back now to 1938 and have a brief listen to part of the broadcast from Orson Welles' War of the Worlds.
I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building. I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Estimated in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchinson River Parkway still kept open for motor traffic. Avoid bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army is wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end. People are holding service here below us in the cathedral. Now I look down the harbor, all manner of boats, overloaded with fleeing population, pulling out from docks. Streets are all jammed, noise and crowds like New Year's Eve in city. Wait a minute, the enemy is now in sight above the Palisades. Five great machines. First one is crossing the river. I can see it from here, wading the Hudson like a man wading through a brook. A bulletin is handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis. Seem to be time and space. Now the first machine reaches the shore. He stands watching, looking over the city. Steel cowlish head is even with his skyscrapers. He waits for the others. They rise like a line of new towers on the city's west side. Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now.
Well, that's the end of that for the time being, and I think you get the idea. But it certainly was had a very devastating effect over in the US, Martin. The thing is, how about this whole thing of blurring drama and reality, and blurring drama and current affairs? Because that's what effectively he was doing there.
Well, yes, and of course this is actually this is a trick or a joke, if you like. But in actual fact, governments since then have actually deliberately engineered events in order to steer political opinions in the direction they want to go, and we've often discussed on this programme the whole phenomenon of false flag terrorism and so on. So the strategy of tension in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, various terrorist attacks were carried out, and they actually carried out terrorist attacks, but they were in order to try and demonise the left. So the bombing of Bologna railway station that killed 80 odd people, this is carried out by the state in order to create a psychological effect. The purpose of this is to create a psychological effect. Now, of course, there wasn't a real alien invasion in the 1940s in the US, and there wasn't a real revolution in Britain in the 1920s, although it's interesting that many people in Britain believed that it was possible to have a revolution in 1920, because they just had the Russian Revolution and so on. But of course, things like the 9/11 attacks and the bombings of Bologna railway station, the whole Gladio stuff, which we're going to talk about Frankovich in a moment, basically modern warfare has become the management of perceptions. And as long as you can get people to believe that something is true, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. As long as you can get them to believe it's true, you can then manipulate them in the direction you want them to go.
Well, Hadley Cantrill, who was involved in this, also published a book not long after it called The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Psychology of Panic. He worked at this Princeton University radio research project, which was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. Also affiliated with the project was the Council on Foreign Relations member and Columbia Broadcasting System CBS executive Frank Stanton. So it seemed that they did actually, it wasn't just a bit of drama that people just took wrong, maybe misconstrued. There was a kind of experimentation on a large proportion of the population. What about this organisation, the Council on Foreign Relations? I come across them quite a lot. It's a sort of influence group funded by big business in the United States that seems to have all sorts of other interests, like, for example, foreign policy. There's a whole side of the Council on Foreign Relations that is looking at foreign policy, another whole side of it, which is influencing media policy.
Yes, I mean, you've got the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, I've mentioned Gladio. People can look these things up. We are now in the age of the internet. I don't have to explain what those different organisations are. If you're that interested, you go away and do a computer search and you will find out what these organisations are all about. And they are overlapping structures within which elite opinion is formed and plans are made and executed, including the manipulation of the population through psychological warfare techniques. And in, modern psychological warfare techniques are related to things like advertising, they're related to things like spin doctoring for politicians, and it's all become one big circus. And I'm afraid that an awful lot of what goes on in the world is in fact delusionary and illusionary.
Well, one of the things, for example, that happened in Syria was at the beginning of the uprising in Syria, there were photographs were actually put on the BBC, weren't they, which were from a previous conflict. I think it was Iraq. Yeah. And there, you do have to ask the question, I mean, how do you get these pictures from a picture library? If so, I mean, how does a picture from a completely different conflict, there was, I think, another one to do with Pakistan as well, where people were in a completely different country.
Well, now you're thinking of the final push on Tripoli in Libya, where Al Jazeera in the morning of the final push on Tripoli was showing footage of supposedly celebrating protesters inside Tripoli, but the first lot of footage came from India. And the second lot of footage was actually on a mock-up of Green Square, which they put together in Qatar with a whole series of extras.
Are you talking about a film studio of some sort?
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, if the 9/11 attack was an inside job, which I believe was the case, then somebody sat down and wrote up a disaster movie script for 9/11. And this is the difference between reality and fiction is now becoming increasingly blurred. And of course, if you think of 9/11 as an inside job, but designed to be a media inside job, so you've got cameras in place to show the horrific collapse of the towers and all the rest of it. Not the third tower, of course, WTC7, where it took the internet to dig that out. But I mean, the purpose of all of this is to create certain kinds of effects. And, you know, the kinds of techniques which were available to Napoleon or Julius Caesar were nothing compared to the modern techniques of mind manipulation and control. Basically, thousands of highly paid people all over the world are spending a lot of time trying to make sure that you believe what they want you to believe, and it's a big business.
Well, this going back to the War of the Worlds, this guy Frank Stanton, he was a rising star in CBS after the broadcast with Awesome Worlds, and went on to become its president. But at the same time, he was parallelly, if you can say that, the chairman of the board of the RAND Corporation. This is another organisation that we come across from time to time. What were they about? Who were the RAND Corporation?
Well, I can't remember what RAND stands for. It's research and something something.
Nothing to do with Ayn Rand, then?
No, nothing to do with Ayn Rand. Not directly. I mean, basically, all of these corporate entities are the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. So most of what we see going on in the world, whether it's information flows or physical acts, such as bombings, shootings, killings, this is all being, not all of it, they're not completely in charge, but there is an awful lot of effort put into making sure that a certain vision of the world is the one that is held by the population so that certain effects can be produced. This is going on, it's as old as history, but the techniques now have become extremely sophisticated.
Well, of course, and you're taking some of these techniques learned in 1938 and putting them into television, it becomes devastatingly powerful. Now, one of the things that fascinated me about the War of the Worlds was the reaction of the it was some recordings of the reaction of the AT&T telephone operators, because of course in those days it wasn't you didn't just dial a number on your phone and get through. You had to first of all speak to an operator and they would connect you, and people who were on their own, maybe didn't have anyone else to talk to in their home, or felt like they needed to talk to someone outside while the World of the War of the Worlds broadcast was going on, picked up the phone to have a chat to the operators, and they were recorded recently with their experiences of what it was like being an operator on the night that that broadcast took place in the United States.
They're going over to New York. Night, the sky's alive with their lights, just as if people were still living.
Because they were crying and screaming and wanting to know if there was a lot of gas, if there was a lot of destruction, were there fires, is there a lot of shooting, are there bodies all around?
But people believed it. They really believed it that night. And I think of the ones who were begging us to get connections to their families, to their husbands, to mothers and fathers, before the world came to an end, so they could just tell them they loved them.
At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill.
One man told me that people were jumping out of the windows and they were going to kill their families before the Martians could get them.
You see, it was not a case of answering a light and connecting them to somebody else. All they wanted was the operator.
I was just so concerned that I was going to be able to help all these people.
That was a recording of some of the telephone operators on the night of the 30th of October back in 1938, who were receiving phone calls from panicked citizens in the United States. Martin, it just goes to show that people really did believe this 100%, didn't they?
Yeah, and if you could actually argue that it was quite an irresponsible thing to do, given the consequences that followed. But more to the point, I think that people need to understand that an awful lot of what goes on is, in fact, orchestrated. So we are presented with things which may or may not have happened, and the spin on them is already built into them. Think of the people who made the anti-Islamic film, which then sparked off the protests in the Middle East, which then led to the assault on the Benghazi consulate, supposedly, of the Americans in Libya. Now, that is all. We've not got to the bottom of that yet, but somebody deliberately made that film, translated it into Arabic, pushed it out in Egypt in order to create an effect. Now, we're not quite sure who did it, but it was definitely deliberate. And that is the world we live in, where people are trying quite hard to steer public opinion through all kinds of tricks and sleight of hand.
Well, earlier this year, I came across a clip. I'd recorded it off of the news from Channel 4 News one Saturday evening, of Jonathan Miller explaining that he was witnessing what he believed to be fighting going on in Damascus, in the capital, whereas the government in Syria was saying there was no fighting going on. And he used as his evidence two video clips. One was a video clip from his cameraman, and one was on YouTube that had been uploaded that day. And he said, well, look, if you actually match these two the two audio tracks of the sounds of gunfire, they match exactly. Well, I actually went through, and he only said that after the clip, so people watching couldn't listen for themselves, went through those clips afterwards and found there was absolutely no collusion, or there was no... The two clips were completely different. One of them had a different number of gunshots, and the spaces between the gunshots in terms of seconds were completely different. But of course, if you're a casual watcher, you just trust Jonathan Miller as a Channel 4 news reporter to be telling you the truth. Actually, it was a lie. That was not actual evidence that that there had been stuff going on in Tripoli. So this thing sort of thing does definitely go on today. Ultimately, I mean, I put a complaint into Ofcom about it, but they basically just said, oh, well, it must have been a mistake. So there was no action taken against it. I think that's actually quite, ethically, a pretty heinous thing to do, to say that two things that you can hear, see, are supposed to be the same when actually they're not. And of course, just casually watching the news, you don't normally record it. You know, I'm a bit of a nerd. Occasionally I will record the news. But as it turned out, the evidence was that it was a con. One thing I will say, though, about the War of the Worlds is this is a very good article about it, which I came across, called Television and the Hive Mind. This was written in 2003 by Mac White, spelt in the way you'd expect, and you can find that one online, and I'll put it up on our page. This whole thing of the hive mind, it's almost like somebody somewhere is thinking of listeners and viewers, members of the public, a sort of mass population, as one kind of creature, or to sort of, and the point he makes in there is that somewhere in the hive is a queen bee. Who's the queen bee?
Well, it's the people who are doing the manipulating who are the queen bees, isn't it? Basically, people generally form their opinions by talking to others. So, if you know, as we've all heard of viral marketing, if you can get a rumour going, then people will generally believe that if people around them believe it. And this is not because people are stupid, it's because we haven't got the time to look into everything. And therefore, of course, we do trust Channel 4, for example, to be telling the truth about whatever it's doing and not trying to deliberately mislead us. But of course, the psychological warfare officers will be deliberately trying to mislead Channel 4. So there may even be a step back from that. You could have genuine journalists who are genuinely purporting what they see, but what they see is being manipulated.
And it's not just psychological warfare people that is working for the military. There's also these massive companies, public relations style firms, yeah, enormous ones, strategic communication companies. Well, that their job is also to do a similar kind of thing.
There's massive overlap between these two worlds. As you know, Tony, we've been working with people who work in this world, and they work both for military and for private sector.
Well, they get a lot more working for the private sector than they do for the military.
Well, indeed, but the military and the private sector are together in terms of manipulating public opinion to achieve certain outcomes, especially military private companies.
And it was news to me that the War of the Worlds wasn't the first one of these experiments on the public. The Bolsheviks are attacking the palace and Big Ben has been destroyed. This was a fake BBC radio bulletin that terrified listeners back in 1926. Apparently Big Ben had been toppled by mortars, the Savoy Hotel had been torched, Buckingham Palace besieged, and the government minister had been lynched in a murderous riot by a mob of the unemployed. The BBC was inundated with calls from terrified listeners over the transmission on January the 16th, 1926, 4 years after its first ever broadcast, all of whom missed one vital fact: the bulletin was a fake. So only 4 years after the birth of the BBC, under Lord Reith, who was actually a big fan of Adolf Hitler in the 1930s, which is by the by, but you don't often hear that on the BBC. This is another one, but this time done in Britain.
Yeah, well, I think it's irresponsible to do these kind of tricks, especially if it's going to cause people upset and problems. But of course, the reality of the reporting of main news, especially war news, I mean, it's a cliche, but it's a true cliche. The first casualty of any war is the truth. And of course, what you do is you basically manipulate people by making them confident that they're hearing genuine opinions, genuine independent sources of information, and then of course you can feed disinformation in there. And that, I'm afraid, has become more than an art. It's become a very, very developed part of public relations, marketing, psychological warfare. These things are big employers in today's world.
And of course, many of these organisations, particularly today, are they're not that transparent. It's very difficult to actually get information about them. I remember, for example, there was a report, an internal report the BBC did, into their coverage of Middle Eastern affairs, looking at bias. And people under the Freedom of Information Act tried to get hold of it. They said, oh no, you can't have it. So there's actually a kind of wall of secrecy around many of our major broadcasters even today.
Well, what we all need to be aware of, and people go on about media studies as a Mickey Mouse A-level, what media studies students learn is who is telling us this, what is their angle, why are they presenting it in this way. And of course, people need to have the skills to understand what they're being told, how they're being told it, who's telling it them, and why. And that's absolutely essential if we're going to preserve any kind of democratic system in this country and other countries.
Well, back to the Bolsheviks attacking the palace, because the thing is, in the 1920s, it was not long after the Russian Revolution, there were also
strikes and so on.
And this kind of thing was going, it was just before the general strike, actually. The full extent of the fallout caused by that report, which was called Broadcasting the Barricades, was revealed in a history of the BBC, which was published in October 2011. The book's author, David Pat Walker, is a former BBC assistant controller. He said, as grave and as utterly unexpected tidings flowed out of the headphones and loudspeakers throughout Britain, a state of alarm swept through the country. Listeners up and down Britain sprang to their telephones, convinced that London had been laid waste. The Savoy Hotel was bombarded with calls from relatives of guests, whilst the Irish Free State made inquiries through diplomatic channels to find out whether the House of Commons had been blown up and if there was anything they could do.
Well, yes, I mean, it all sounds rather amusing with hindsight. I bet it wasn't that amusing at the time. And it just shows how febrile the atmosphere was, with the Russian Revolution having happened in the previous decade and the general strike about to kick off. People thought it was a credible story.
The Knox broadcast certainly can't boast. It was a guy who did it, was Knox, can't
boast the terrifying verisimilitude of the War of the Worlds, peppered as it was with his mischievous observations on the unlikely progress of the rioters. Unquestionably, it was a very clever and amusing piece of work. But listen to today, the original broadcast apparently has got lost, but you can hear a reconstruction on the BBC website, or at least you used to be able to. There's nothing about it that can be described as particularly disturbing or frightening, but according to reports at the time, women fainted, mayors dusted off their emergency plans, and one listener even called the Admiralty, demanded that the Navy dispatched up the Thames.
Well, I mean, it all sounds very amusing with hindsight, but of course there's a very serious point that we're getting at here, which is that in the modern era that we're living in now, in 2012, lots of people are trying to bend our heads.
Palmer there with the fanfare for the common man. Now, we're joined by James Dury on the phone. Last week we heard a bit about the local enterprise partnership, the LEP, and something called the City Deal. So I'm joined by James Dury. Now, James is one of the directors of what is effectively Bristol Chamber of Commerce and Business West, also on the executive board of the local enterprise partnership. Hi, James, and welcome to Drive Time.
Yeah, evening, Tony.
Now, first of all, how did the local enterprise partnership, or the LEP, how did it start?
It was set up really. It came hot on the heels of the election of the coalition government, and that coming into place. And really, it was a response from prompted by central government that they decided that they didn't want to carry on with the regional structure, so the Regional Development Agency. And this was an opportunity that this area took up, being west of England, Greater Bristol, what used to be Avon, dare I say, years ago, to really focus on how to create an environment and a space to think about jobs and economic growth, business and local government and universities working together to focus on how best we can create more jobs and the environment that people want to bring investment and activity, set up businesses, etc.
Okay, so how are you different to the old RDA then?
Well, it's fundamentally different on the basis that the old RDAs, regional development agencies, were in effect arms of central government with a sort of formal set of powers and some responsibilities and some resources. The local enterprise partnerships, of which we're the West of England version is one of 47 across England, wasn't set up with any formal powers or any actual responsibilities, and in fact no new resources, certainly initially. But what it has got is an open remit and an opportunity to work directly with government, both with the officials and with the ministers, to tell our government what we need in terms of how we're going to grow our economy. So it's fundamentally different. It's the existing organisations working through a partnership structure on focusing on economic growth.
So have you got any powers to really twist their arms, James? I mean, it's all very well to tell them what they should be doing, but it's actually quite difficult to actually get funds and finance at the moment, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I have to say, the reality is, of course, we've got a government who are looking very hard at where jobs can come from, where new private sector jobs particularly can come from, at a time when clearly, you know, there's a big squeeze on nationally, let alone internationally. It's less, I think, for this era about actually trying to get lots of new public money, because bluntly there isn't a lot of new public money, and what there is being cut. What it is making sure we do get our fair share of that, but also we think about and we get the support for the kind of some of the base infrastructure that this area needs and perhaps has missed opportunities in the past, but also we create an environment where private money wants to come in, people are willing to take risks that they aren't because they think that this is a good place to back.
Well, we had a visit, didn't we, recently from Nick Clegg, and one of his main things, the Deputy Prime Minister, was to sign this city deal in Bristol. Now, I know that the local enterprise partnership's part of that. What is the city deal? What are we getting?
So the city deal is one of a number of deals that central government have forged with places around England, really the major cities, of which Bristol is you know, in the top three. In fact, Bristol is with the top of performing English city after London and the South East. And it's an opportunity for this area to really, in return for committing to try to certain levels of growth, we can potentially hang on. No, we not potentially. We can hang on to some of the money they created through creating new taxes, new business rates. Hold on to that money locally, rather than sending it back into HM Treasury, as traditionally has happened. I'm afraid, we do have one of the most centralist countries in the world, let alone in Europe. And this is a move, actually, from this government to try and repatriate some of the powers, but also the responsibility, the money back locally to areas, and let them choose where the money is spent.
You mentioned business rates. That's something that comes up quite a bit on the programme here. This whole sort of question, really, over why is it that quite a lot of people that are landowners, maybe have got buildings or whatever, because those buildings are empty, they seem to pay less business rates than everybody else, and they get actually tax breaks from one reason or another for leaving buildings empty, when actually what you and I and everyone else wants is those buildings full up with people who are employed at maybe a bit of a less rent.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's quite a specific point, which I have to say we, as the Chamber of Commerce, have made that point around rates and what the specific, particularly for all businesses, but it's the small businesses which really are having a really tough time. And actually, you're right, we do need empty space to be occupied with people working, setting up businesses, having space in which to kind of, you know, do whatever they do in whatever line of business. So there are a whole specific range of issues that, you know, the LEP gives us actually a better platform, or a sort of united platform, public and private, to talk to government about. But through the city deal, really, it's about actually our four unitary authorities, Bristol, North Somerset, South Gloucester and Bath, North East Somerset, having the ability to hang on to some of the tax, as opposed to, at the moment, the current system, which I think not enough people know about. Actually, the current system is all businesses out there at the moment pay business rates, the money goes into the HM Treasury, that gets redistributed elsewhere, and I have to say this area loses out through that process, because we pay money in, but proportionately less comes back. So actually this is the move that the city deal, I think, is the first step in potentially what could be quite a lot of repatriation of tax raising and local tax raising ability back to this area, which can only be good news, because it puts more of the onus on us to, first of all, to grow, but if we do, we can financially win out of it.
Okay, so let's go back to the Local Enterprise Partnership, the LEP, because this is quite a new thing for a lot of people. How is it actually made up? Who's on the Local Enterprise Partnership? Who are the partners?
Sorry, it just crackled on the line there. Did you say?
Yeah, just saying, who are the partners? Yeah.
It's basically a business and local government partnership with the universities also as on the board, representing both the importance they bring economically, but also they are major employers. You know, the University of Bristol is one of the largest employers in the city, for instance. But all four of the universities are therefore represented through one of the vice-chancellors. But there are four seats from business, there are four seats from local government, which the local government have the leaders sat on the board. Business has representatives from different sectors, which are really identified as some of the growth sectors and kind of leading business people, so from Airbus, from Toshiba Research, from Aardman Animations, and from Bristol Airport. And then we have a because these things are business-led, we have a business person, Colin Skellett, who's the chairman of Wessex Water, based over in Bath, who is the chair of the partnership. So it is very much a business-led partnership, but in partnership with local government.
Okay. Now, one of the things that came up last week when we were talking with various mayor candidates was this something called the Public Property Board, which it looks like will be finalised by early next year. And I mean, the question is, of course, what's the problem with Bristol City Council, their own property services people, just managing property? Because we've got a fantastic amount of land and buildings. Some people say 40% of Bristol is actually owned by the city, and surely that's for the city to manage, not for you know, people like Toshiba, Airbus, Bristol Airport, and Aardman Animations. When why would they be involved in managing public land? I mean, they're private businesses.
Well, it wouldn't be for anyone specifically, any of those one business to be directly involved, you know, in their corporate capacity with managing those public assets. But as part of the city deal, what this area is committed to is to seeing how we can collectively manage certainly the public assets in a way where actually they're looked at more holistically. So it's not just the city council assets which are being looked at through this property board, but also all the central government property assets from all the different government departments, so including the, you know, the Ministry of Defence, etc., etc., but also the other national agency which is set up to focus on regeneration and jobs, which is the Homes and Communities Agency, which has some of the assets which were previously within the Regional Development Agency on it now on its books. And actually what the idea is that actually you better look at all the public assets at a time when I think, you know, everybody's trying to look better at kind of how we can create value when there's less in the pot generally, to see, you know, if there is innovative ideas about how you actually realise value, because and have business represented there in some way is felt to be a necessity, but not in a controlling way, but in a way that actually you're getting the best of the public and private working together to think about public assets and how they're used now ongoing. I think we're seeing it through, not just through Bristol, but all the councils are having to rationalise how they occupy space, how they use their assets, and property is one of those components. So this is really a positive move to try and see how best we can realise value, but also how they can rationalise assets. You know, you're right, there are big land assets in Bristol, some of which, you know, just aren't realisable and shouldn't be touched. There's a big housing portfolio, for instance, which, you know, it's not contained to, you know, it's not relevant for that to be looked at. But actually, there are other passages which, you know, there's potential to look at them in a different way.
Okay, finally then, just with your role as a local enterprise partnership, looking at this business of, I mean, we have figures of something like 1.75 million square feet of empty offices, which comes up here the last 3 or 4 weeks we've mentioned this. Lots and lots of empty offices. Is there anything that you'd like to see changed or done in order to bring those offices into... Because there's clearly the rents that are being charged for the offices that are being used need to come down in order to have a realistic market in rent in the city, so that we can start to see new businesses flourishing in some of these empty offices. There's nothing more heartbreaking than going past one of these new offices to see that it's either entirely empty or maybe has only got people in on the ground floor.
Well, markets, of course, go in, you move in patterns and waves, there will always be a proportion of space which is vacant, because there'll be people moving in, moving out, there'll be people speculatively calling the market and bringing buildings to the market, and there'll be a period of time which normally that they will remain empty, because sometimes the demand doesn't come on tap at the same time as the supply comes forward. I think we've had 5 years of a really challenging economy. Speaking from Business West, let alone the LEP, I think we recognise that there are, at the moment, there is quite a lot of office space out there. When actually look at it, there isn't a huge amount of what you describe as the prime office space. Some of the office space, I think, you know, the world has changed, really, and the demand for office space has diminished. And Bristol, you know, there is a time lag sometimes between when the supply and demand, really. I mean, I think some of the demand we see going forward is probably likely to be more in the affordable bracket. I think there is recognised both by business and by the public sector that actually providing affordable space in the right places, the right sort of quality, where people can come in, move out quickly, they're all fixed into long-term leases, is where we need to be if we need to stimulate particularly smaller businesses. And I think the LEP absolutely recognises that, you know, 98% of our businesses are small businesses, and you know, we as the Chamber of Commerce, we spend a huge amount of our time and resource, absolutely appropriately, working with and for small businesses, because they're the ones that ultimately are the kind of the main bedrock upon which our economy is built, really. And so, you know, providing affordable space is very much part of the challenge.
Yeah, I said finally, but I've just thought of something else I want to ask you. Sorry, James. And that is that one of the changes with any kind of partnership, you've got two different ways of doing things in business and in local government. Local government meetings are all open to the public. You can come along, sit there, watch. You can't necessarily speak, but at least you can witness what's going on and possibly, comment on it through some letter or formal channels. And business is very different. Business is, you know, you can't just go along to a company's board meeting. So what's the situation with the LEP? What side of the stall do you fall on?
Well, the LEP has made it very clear that it is open for anybody to come and engage with the LEP. And whilst the board meetings themselves are held in private, the minutes are published. There are annual meetings held of the LEP where it can be, where it can account for itself, and it's very clear that it actually doesn't have any formal powers. It's aimed to build some influence, but at the end of the day, the formal statutory powers remain with central government, with the unitary authorities, and elsewhere. The LEP is there to try and add value and to try and add extra momentum in how we create the environment jobs. So it's been set up along business lines to try and give the best focus for that in a way that, at the end of the day, you know, businesses, we've got over 700 businesses involved in our LEP. We are, I don't know if you picked those up, Tony, but the Western England LEP has been recognised by the Financial Times as being felt to be the number one LEP in the country. So we've got local government and business and the universities really working together in a fantastic way. At the moment, we seem to have the formula right. I think there are challenges ahead and the challenges around delivery. But getting that sort of blend right where business and local government and universities are happy to sit around the table and we get the best out of everybody is a constant challenge. At the end of the day, the board members are there giving their all. They've got very busy day jobs and they're committing their time and effort, and the likes of ourselves at Business West, but also the other partners are the Institute of Directors, the CBI, the Federation of Small Business. We're all committing to this because actually there's enough people that think we need to be working together, and this is the right platform. Fortunately, it has a sort of mandate where government have set it up, so therefore they recognise what it is and they seem to be listening. But clearly, at the end of the day, our key task is to try and set a clear view about why this place is a good place in which to operate already, why existing businesses should grow. We've set out now six areas across the greater, well, across the West of England area where there is potential to create about 100,000 new jobs over the next 20 years, and the challenge is to really making that happen in a way where actually, you know, you benefit everybody here and the people that undoubtedly will want to come here. So hopefully that gives you a bit of a flavour, Tony.
Thanks very much. Yes, and I noticed that you've got a conference coming up in December 2012. If anybody particularly wants to find out, that's the point at which members of the public can come and find out what you're up to. Particularly, I'm sure there'll be quite a lot of people who would be interested to know what you're going to be doing with this public land and your public property board. So, anyway, thanks very much.
I basically encourage anybody, please, to come along and look at the website. It's definitely... We are open and we are keen to engage anybody who is interested in the growth agenda.
Thanks very much, James Jury, who is a director of the Bristol Chamber of Commerce, that's Business West, and also an executive board of the Local Enterprise Partnership. Thank you, James.
Cheerio, good night.
Eid al-Adha is a very special time for Muslims in Bristol and throughout the world. It is a time of reflection, it is a time to demonstrate charity and to join together to consider our duties to those around us as well as to ourselves. This includes everybody in the city of Bristol. On this special day, I would like to pay tribute to the significant contribution made by the Muslim community to our city of Bristol. I would like to extend our warmest wishes to you and your family for Eid al-Adha. From me, Hibak Sharma, on behalf of BCFM 93.2.
Right, now Martin, we've got some international news stories. I think probably one of the most interesting ones maybe we should start with is this presidential debate that there was at the end of last weekend with Mitt Romney. What's your overall thoughts about the US presidential election, because that's coming up very soon now? There's only 3 or 4 weeks to go.
Yes, well, it's probably the most important vote that takes place on the planet, and you know, most of us haven't got a vote in it, even though it's going to decide an awful lot.
What about the two candidates, though? I know one of your I was chatting to you a couple of weeks ago, and you were saying, well, I think Mitt Romney. There may be a connection between the election and potential conflict in the Middle East. What are your thoughts on that one?
Well, I think it's quite clear that the Israeli lobby in the US are very solidly behind Romney, and Sheldon Adelson, who's one of his main funding backers, he's a casino millionaire, but he's also a super right-wing Israeli politician in the sense that he wants a war with Iran, and Romney has promised them a war if he gets elected.
Well, one of the other things he's promised is that he's going to do this presidential debate last weekend, but he was very geographically challenged during that debate, Romney. I mean, at least Barack Obama didn't make any such devastating errors in his geography, and it's a bit worrying to think that the President of the United States might actually not know anything about the geography of the Middle East, but yet he's conducting a war there.
Well, yes, and I think the problem is that we get bogged down in wondering who's going to win this presidential election, when in actual fact the major outlines of US policy, both on the economy and on geopolitics, are fairly clear, and it's basically confrontation all the way, whoever wins. With a smile on the face, we get Obama, with a snarl if we get Romney.
Well, what Romney actually did say was that Syria is Iran's only ally in the Arab world. It's their route to the sea. It's the route for them to arm Hezbollah in Lebanon, which threatens, of course, our ally Israel. And so seeing Syria remove and so seeing Syria removing Assad is a very high priority for us. Now, what he's saying there is, in fact, is a mirror image of a past war, which is Kuwait and Iraq, not the present situation.
Well, it's not. It's just the geographical challengeness of what he's saying.
I mean, first of all, he's saying that
Iran has no border with Syria, and it's not their road to the sea. They've got plenty of access to the sea in the Persian Gulf. But I mean, these are minor points. I think what's really people ought to take on board is that we are now seriously talking about a war with Iran, and there is every possibility that Ryan, who is Romney's running mate, will get control of the economy if they win the election, and they are determined to slash the budget deficit, not by stopping military expenditure, but by basically stopping QE and cutting Medicaid and Medicare, all of which will, in my view, most likely crash the markets. So you're looking at a crash and a war, whoever wins.
Well, Iran is actually a democratic country and actually a peaceful nation. So what's the justification for war?
Well, we've been through this umpteen times. There is just innate hostility between the Iranians and the US ruling class, because the Iranians simply won't play ball according to the way they want them to play ball. The Iranians are up for negotiations. They've been up for negotiations all the way. So, for example, they did a deal with the Turks and the Brazilians about their nuclear enrichment, which was exactly the same as the deal that Obama had been demanding. And as soon as that was put on the table, he immediately withdrew the deal and said, no, we don't want to deal with you.
But what about for Britain? What are the legalities?
Well, it's interesting, in The Guardian today, the Attorney General has circulated the whole cabinet and all the leadership in Britain saying an unprovoked attack on Iran is illegal. No ifs, no buts, it's illegal. And it strikes me that we shouldn't be making illegal threats. We can't threaten to attack Iran unless they break the rules. They're not breaking the rules, therefore we can't threaten to attack them. That is the legal position.
I mean, as has happened many times before, a provocation be manufactured, engineered?
Ah, well, provocations are being manufactured and engineered as we speak, talking about what we were talking about earlier in the hour. I mean, there's been assassinations on Iranian scientists. There's been the Stuxnet and Flame viruses, which have been infiltrated into their nuclear computers, which possibly found their way to Fukushima. And there's MEK and the Kurdish Party for Peace and Life, who are basically being armed by the West, and the Baluchistan terrorists being armed by the West. Iran is under constant physical assault from the West already. It's surprising that they've been as calm as they have been. But of course, if there is an unprovoked attack on Iran, they've made it absolutely clear that they will retaliate. People in Britain need to take that on board. We can't be going to war with Iran. It's a silly idea.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Also here today, a British oil executive was assassinated at a restaurant in Brussels, Belgium, nearly 2 weeks ago. This is the bizarre twist of this, is that there was a news blackout on the story. I'd actually seen, I tweeted it myself, my Twitter account, at Tony Gosling, 2 weeks ago, and I would definitely recommend a couple of websites which had this story very early on. One is Cryptogon, at cryptogon.com, and the other one is blacklistednews.com. But Martin, it's a rather bizarre that something, basically a British national, senior guy in the Exxon, which is the Rockefeller funded, originally the Rockefeller shares in the Exxon Mobil company, is assassinated, but no one's allowed to know.
Well, I mean, this is a specific case, and it's very hard to comment. It's only come out today. Who knows?
Well, it came out 2 weeks ago, is what I'm saying, but it was in the mainstream press, didn't touch it for whatever reason.
It may be that there's more to this than meets the eye. There usually is, but it's for the police to investigate and not for me to speculate sitting here on BBC.
No, I'm not asking you to speculate. I'm asking you to talk about this, at least this idea that something like this, as devastating as this, can happen in the street in open daylight where everyone can see it, and yet it's not reported.
Well, I'm not quite sure of the details of this particular case. I presume the Belgian police were keeping it under wraps because they had suspicions in relation to what was happening. I really don't know. I mean, things like this are happening all the time, and it's easy to jump to judgment. Don't presume you know what's going on until you do.
It says, in accordance with Belgian investigative protocol. It sounds like they wanted to wrong foot the people that had done it, possibly. Finally, jamming interrupts Western broadcasters. Now, this is a kind of jamming war going on over in the Middle East, and Press TV has been banned from satellites as well as 19 Syrian and Iranian channels. Most of these are Iranian channels, are now been blocked from the UTEL satellite. And these satellites are privately owned, but they've stopped the Iranians broadcasting from them.
well, all of this is very worrying and implies that we're going to war, so we can't possibly hear the Iranians' point of view because it might be upsetting for people. Therefore, we make sure they can't hear it and substitute our own point of view for their point of view.
Well, freedom of expression is guaranteed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights under Article 19, I seem to remember, but yet you can just switch off a satellite because someone on a board of a company has decided that.
Well, it's presumably because of pressure from the Western governments rather than just a commercial decision. It's very worrying.
But it's part of the sanctions which has been instituted by the EU. This is not
the UN, and not by the non-aligned movement met in Iran not long ago. That's all of the basically the third world countries, and they basically agreed with the Iranian position and not with our position. So when we talk about the international community tells Iran to do this, that and the other, they mean the Israelis and the Western powers. Everybody else
is
on the Iranian side.
The foreign minister of the EU is Baroness Ashton, who answers to the royal family. She's a baroness. She's never been elected to do anything in her life, but she's closed down the TV transmitters. Unbelievable. Anyway, Martin, time to sign off now, but it's just the start of your Friday night talk radio extravaganza coming up now. The Typical Topical Afro-Tropical Show. I'm Tony Gosling. This show is online at www.thisweek.org.uk.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.